Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Romain Guy from the Android Toolkit team.
I'm Frank Yang on the Android emulator.
Hey, welcome. More tools. That's what we like.
But the best kind of tools.
Yes. Emulator. What's that?
Well, it evens the playing field for Android developers. Using the Android emulator, any Android app developer can use the emulator as a virtual device without requiring to buy all the latest phones and tablets. They can try their app with a different ranges of screen sizes and API levels, including getting the latest Android API levels before they're widely available.
So actually, there's something interesting. Android, we use an emulator, not a simulator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Can you explain the difference?
Sure. With an emulator, the difference is basically that the implementation area is highly reduced compared to a simulator. If you implement a simulator, you'll need to re-implement the Android APIs for Windows, Mac, and Linux. With an emulator, you need to mostly only take care of the kernel and the HAL side of things. And so it makes it really easy to upgrade between Android releases. So for example, if we want to bring up Android Q, right, we need to, if you're in the kind of simulator kind of situation, you'll need to add all these new APIs to your host OS, whether it be Windows, Mac OS, or Linux. In contrast with the emulator, you need to make sure that your hardware abstraction layers are still working, which is often a lot less work.
So that also means that as far as Android is concerned, like the OS doesn't really know it's in an emulator. It's just a different type of device.
Correct.
And that makes everything really correct as well, right? Because the app isn't doing different things in the simulator and on the app. It's really just running all the same operating system software.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct.
What's the downside to an emulator?
The downside?
Yeah. I mean, we heard lots of upsides. It's easier to port. Okay. It's more accurate. Why would anyone else have a simulator?
So simulators do have a few nice things going for them. For example, simulators, they will have less CPU usage and RAM overhead. The main difference being that if you're running an emulator, you often need to declare all of your memory address spaces up front. And if you don't like manage that well with like lazy memory backing and so forth, that can result in more memory usage than if you're using a simulator. And in addition, if you're using an emulator, all of your hard disks and so forth need to be virtualized, which if you're using interrupt-driven devices, which is like every device, I guess, you'll need to run polling loops and so forth on the host in order to make these efficient.
I see. So just the machine sitting there idly on the home screen is not really idle for the host computer because it is simulating it doing something.
Right. Like for network and block devices, there's probably like sets of outstanding transactions that the host needs to wait on and then re-notify the guest when data becomes available to read or write.
And this is an area you've been focusing on recently, right? As part of Project Marble?
Yes. So that's we noticed that one of the top complaints about the Android emulator was around resource usage. And we did address that a bit over the summer with emulator 28.0.x. For RAM usage, and we fixed a few memory leaks, but then there's also this CPU usage that happens, especially when you're just leaving the emulator on the home screen idle. Right. And we found that like these idle polling loops were a source of that CPU usage.
Right, and you've been writing these release notes for each weekly canary, which are kind of fun to read. I think my favorite one is the one recently where it turns out that if you have a system image, and you have the play services in it, services gets really busy all of a sudden, apps and running in the background, and this is not free.
Right, indeed. So I think that is due to so we eventually found out what that was because, and I want to first talk about the effect of auto-updating apps in the background when Play Services is running. So we seem to find out it happens whether you're logged into a Google account or not. So when you freshly boot up the emulator and you're just leaving it on your computer and you're maybe just left to do a build or you're doing something else with your time, and then all of a sudden you find that your computer's fans start spinning like crazy. And we find that that can be because of updating all of your apps in the background.
So it sounds like it does behave like a real device. So it's like you achieve what you set out to do.
Yeah, it's like, right. Oh, nothing is happening here. The Indeed. User left the device down. I am going to go ahead and update everything.
Right. Yes. So that also touches on this thing where we often have to walk this fine line between giving a good user experience for the virtual device on a desktop or laptop machine versus having the greatest fidelity for simulating Android.
And so what did you do?
So we found that like the main driver of causing lots of background updates or not is actually based on whether your phone is plugged in charging or whether it's on battery. And we found that in the like recent release notes and before, like one or two release notes back, we had this option to change the emulator screen off timeout to a very high value, 24 days. Now,
well, the issue is that you want to, you switch to battery mode, right?
Right.
And that
yes.
stops this, but then on battery, the screen times out.
Yeah, that's correct. So if you run your device on battery, that means the Android is allowed to turn off your screen at, much sooner. And that can be kind of hard to deal with if suddenly you're doing something and then the emulator screen turns black and you don't know what's going on. So we added that screen off timeout to the maximum signed integer number of milliseconds, which works out to 24 days about. And then that allows you to put the emulator on battery power and leave it on. And when you're in this situation, you have a lot less background activities.
So is that going to be the new default mode if you just boot up an emulator in Studio? We will be running
yes,
on battery.
That is the plan. And we'll provide a command line flag to go back to the old behavior if you want the kind of fidelity of that.
Nice. Okay. What are some other things you've done around sort of CPU idling?
So another big source of CPU can be when you have an app foregrounded versus when you're just on a home screen or in the launcher. So when you're on the home screen or the launcher, we have, especially if you're on Google APIs, the Google search app is running. And it's also listening for words like, okay, Google, to allow that to work. And we found that this was consuming quite a bit of CPU. So what would be happening was the Android OS in the virtual machine, it would be constantly polling for people saying, okay, Google. It's called hot word detection. And on real devices, this tends to not be very expensive because they can directly talk to the hardware DSP. In contrast, on the emulator, the polling for audio needs to go all the way to the host and talk to the host audio driver, like Core Audio on Mac, for example, and that introduces quite a bit of overhead. And so one of the recent things that we did was to, as an ADB command on startup, to revoke the microphone permissions for the Google app if you've cold booted. And now that has the effect of reducing CPU usage. We saw in Task Manager on Windows, the emulator could go down from 4% CPU when on a home screen to only 1% to 2%.
And you do this only on the home screen. So if I'm writing a video chat app, the microphone's not going to be broken in an emulator, is it?
We also kind of disabled the host audio input overall.
I see, because it was maybe unexpected for some users that just
exactly.
worked.
Right.
I see.
Yeah.
So you would opt into this again if you are actually trying to do...
Yes. Yeah, you would need to opt into it again using either a command line flag, console command, or through the UI to turn host audio back on explicitly.
Right. That's interesting because our phones have a lot of DSPs that we use for a number of things. I mean, audio is one of them, but I imagine that this problem could come back. We'd see a high CPU usage because obviously your laptop doesn't have those DSPs.
And what are some, I know you were doing more things around CPU, right? Weren't there a bunch of graphics driver optimizations?
Right.
And
yes. So in decreasing CPU usage of the emulator, we don't have to only think about when the emulator is idle. When the emulator is not idle, there's also things we can improve there. And one of them is when you're running simple animations. Like, for example, if you go to the stopwatch app and play the stopwatch. So when we're doing that, we found that we're doing a lot of work to send the OpenGL commands from the guest to the host. And some of that work was unnecessary. Those of you who know more about OpenGL will get what I'm talking about. What we always processed all vertex attributes, every draw call, which is not great. And we had this thing where you only process the vertex attributes that changed or were actually bound during the draw call. So that cut down on the overhead by quite a bit. So we also had this unit test of testing the overhead of the emulator OpenGL driver by running actual OpenGL draw commands, but when we get to the host, we would no-op them. So when you run the emulator drivers in this way, like the throughput you're getting will be limited purely by the emulator overhead. And we did some recent optimizations where we were able to get about like a 3 to 4x decrease in the overhead. Like we went from 1.5 million empty draw calls a second to 4.5 million. So I think that's pretty good. And yeah.
That's great. So where can users get all this stuff?
Well, this was a recent change to the emulator system image. So they can't directly benefit from it yet.
I see. So when we ship whatever dessert letter we'll come up with next. Any bets on that, by the way?
Well, we just shipped P, right?
Right.
So we're running out of letters.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting easier and easier to guess the next one.
Are there any good desserts that starts with a Q?
I do not know.
Yeah, okay.
Can't think of anyone, of any.
Yes. All right.
Put me on the spot, Tor.
Okay. And I think that the canary channel for emulator is a separate, is that tied to the same setting as the canary channel for studio? Now, it used to be separate, but I don't know if we combined the two.
It is tied to the canary channel in studio.
All right. So you studio canary and you'll get emulator canary.
Yes. So if you're on, you've been using Android Studio 3.5,
and why
you've been
you?
Using canaries. Right. Exactly. So you'll be using the new emulator as well with all those CPU usage improvements.
Cool.
So you just mentioned that those improvements are in the system image. So that's typically what we install on the device. So that's the part we completely control.
Mm-hmm.
But our emulator is based on QEMU, right?
Yes.
Yes. So that's an open source project.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. And how, like, do we make changes to QEMU? Do we contribute back? Or is most of the work purely in our system images?
We contribute a few things back, and we generally don't keep very in sync with upstream QEMU, although every now and then we will merge all the latest things from upstream QEMU. Recent things that have gone back to them, like in some form or another, is a few years back there was support for Mac OS Hypervisor Framework, and that made it in there. It was based off of like Vir2, which is another emulator engine. And another thing that, a set of things that we added to QEMU was kind of enhanced snapshot support. So we're not really sure if this is that upstreamable, but the idea was to be able to support generic callbacks to save guest RAM.
Yeah, so that part, so the snapshot system is mm-hmm. really impressive. I remember when I first played with it and I could snapshot, and I still use it every day almost, where I snapshot like a running through the application and it comes back just the way it was. So how does that work? Like,
okay, so this may be one of the advantages of having an emulator over a simulator. With a simulator, you're essentially going to need to do a process snapshot, which can be very complicated depending on your OS. However, with an emulator, all of the device state is mostly contained in the guest RAM, along with the CPU registers, which are also easy to save since they're virtual CPUs, and the state of the virtual devices, which can be very difficult to save if you're if you want to save the state of OpenGL, for example.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that one, that doesn't sound that easy.
But right. So
miraculous. I mean, you did it. Right? Yeah. That's the most impressive part to me is, and we demoed this at I.O. last year, right? Mm-hmm. When we had this big 3D demo that we sort of snapshot and it comes right back and continues.
Right.
How in the world does that work?
Well, I think it's got kind of like an exercise in attention to detail. We eventually got it working, but it was looking at the OpenGL state tables and then looking at how we can access the state through the OpenGL API. Like we can query the current vertex attributes, their bindings, and the current textures. And there were a few things that the OpenGL API doesn't provide in all cases, such as readback of textures, which is not really going to give you general readback of textures in all situations. For example, if you have a depth buffer and that's backed by a texture, you're not going to be able to read that back using a GL-readPixels unless you have an extension. And this is where we kind of took advantage of the fact that we were translating from OpenGL-ES to Desktop GL. And Desktop GL has this pretty nifty function called GL-getTextImage, which seems to work universally. And without that, that critical piece, it probably wouldn't work because we would need to be able to reliably read back textures.
Yeah, or I imagine we could always do the tracking ourselves, but that could be very expensive.
Yeah.
And were there other challenges? I mean, I imagine it was not easy to implement snapshotting, but GL was clearly one.
I just think that the save and restore is so fast compared to how much data is being processed. There's got to be tricks there too.
So in terms of saving and restoring the overall state, I would say that the most tricky part besides graphics was the RAM, because these virtual devices, they come with 1.5 to 4 gigabytes of RAM.
Right.
And that's a lot if you want to just hit file save on that. So that's kind of what we used initially for quick boot. We would start up the emulator, and then when you're done with the emulator, you close the emulator and save a snapshot on exit. And then a lot of people complained that the saving time, the time taken to close, was just like 30 seconds or longer. And we eventually figured out some optimizations to that. But then at some point, we made an optimization in 28.0, which made it so that we used a mapped file as the guest RAM. Now, this had some advantages in that if you use a mapped file for RAM, then you can on-demand load it when you start up a snapshot. So loading is fast. And then when you close it, saving is also at least apparently fast, because to save a mapped file, you just unmap the file. In other words, for the emulator, you just close the process. And so that basically ends up leveraging all of the awesome work that Linux, Windows, Mac OS, OS developers have done in making paging optimal. And we're able to get really fast saves that way. And in addition to that, we can also start up the snapshots where the guest RAM is mapped in copy on write mode. So this on Linux, this would be map private, and Windows has copy on write as well. And so this lets us start up two instances of the same AVD from the same snapshot, but have them share their memory until they write to the same place, in which case a copy will be made.
And I'm assuming if this is the RAM of the emulator, it will start writing pretty quickly, right?
Like, right. So
during boot even.
Yeah, that's totally right. And if you do a snapshot while you're booting, you'll likely be writing a lot more RAM than if you're just running an app, because the efficiency of like this kind of saving, it depends on the working set when you're running your snapshot. We found that most Android apps, if they're relatively simple and they don't do too much, lots of like very high bandwidth operations on RAM, like maybe if you're building Linux kernel, you find that they don't have very large working sets, maybe like hundreds of megabytes, or even below 100. And that's kind of what enables us to sort of just be very cavalier and say, if you want to save the snapshot, unmap it. And if you want to load a snapshot, map it.
Right. When Android runs, there's a zygote process, right?
Right.
Which is sort of this thing that's just replicated and used over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Could you do something like that with the emulator, where you sort of have these snapshots are really mm-hmm. just deltas over this common big blob of what Android is, plus the user's app?
Right. Yes. So we can definitely accomplish some form of incrementalism with the privately mapped snapshots, but that incrementalism currently occurs in a kind of opaque manner out of our reach.
I see.
So that like if you run two snapshots and you map the RAM file privately, they'll share the RAM that they're in common. But then if you want to also turn around and say, I want to save the changes of one emulator versus another on exit, There currently isn't really, at least that I know of, a good cross-platform way to tell the OS to save only the changes somewhere. I would love for this to be a feature in current OSs.
Right, because in theory, it would be pretty fantastic if, let's say, if I want to save a snapshot once a frame during an animation, I imagine I'm not touching that much RAM from frame to to frame. So if we could just output like a delta compared to the base snapshot, then for debugging, that would be pretty fantastic.
Yeah. And we could probably implement this in some form, although it would require moving away from the map memory model again and going back to explicit calls to read and write. One of the things that would help this is modern hypervisors, they have ways to do dirty page tracking. So KVM and Haxim and Hypervisor Framework, they all have different ways to set memory protections on the guest RAM. So when the guest performs a write and the page is protected, it will trigger a callback in a kind of virtual page fault instead of simply letting them access the memory. And that lets us gives us a point to track which pages have changed since the last snapshot. And so it's definitely possible.
You do your own form of virtual memory.
Yeah, right.
Speaking of hypervisors, could you talk about that for a while? What is a hypervisor? Talk about Haxim and sort of all the issues we had around that.
And why would you want it?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, like when we're talking about hypervisors and like Android Studio, and you see all this documentation about installing Haxim or Hyper-V or Windows Hypervisor Framework, what we're referring to isn't really QEMU or like a var fork of it, but kind of the layers that it runs on underneath. So what those hypervisors do is they are CPU hardware features that allow you to run emulation just by saying, hey CPU, point your instruction pointer at this address and let her rip. I've set up all this safety things for you so that if you suddenly run into an illegal instruction or you're virtual machine wants to panic, you don't end up panicking in the real world. So a hypervisor, one of the most fundamental things that it does is provide this isolation so that if you do a kernel panic in your virtual machine, it doesn't become a real panic. It's kind of like Inception. One of the other valuable things that it does is like it does this through isolating the address spaces. So part of the package for hypervisors is also having separate page tables for your virtual machine so that your memory accesses can be fast. And so it's a really useful technology, although, yes, it does come with a bit of setup issues in some cases.
Yeah, but so the idea is really like to have a virtual machine that happens to run on the actual hardware as opposed to the traditional emulator where it's all software based.
Exactly. So when people think of emulators, often like the hello world of emulators, you come up with writing a software CPU of your target CPU of choice.
Yeah, usually you have your variable called PC, and that's the instruction pointer for your virtual CPU. And
indeed.
I mean, long-term Android developers, this is what they'll think of an emulator, right? Because you would launch an ARM image on your non-ARM desktop, and we were just simulating the instructions, and it was very, very slow.
Indeed.
And then...
Yeah, and then you could be running an x86 Android image on an x86 hardware. And then when you're in that situation, it makes less sense to pull up these instructions out and have your own PC counter. It makes more sense to say, point your CPU at the memory in the Android OS and just let it go. And that's what hypervisors let us do.
Right. So for a while we shipped, well, we maybe still do, we use Haxim, right?
Right.
Is that just on the Mac or is that on...
So Haxim is... we are Haxim first on Windows. Haxim will provide the best experience. It's very fast. And
Haxim is a virtualization framework provided by Intel, right?
Yes. So Haxim will take care of interfacing with the x86 virtualization features, such as like the inception levels and the different page tables and stuff.
And this works if you have an Intel microprocessor.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And then on Linux, we use KVM.
Right. Yes.
Is that a hypervisor?
Yeah, so that's a hypervisor in the very same sense that Axum is a hypervisor. It provides an interface to the x86 virtualization features so that you can set up emulation.
And is KVM limited to Intel CPUs, or does it work with AMD CPUs as well?
Well, KVM actually works with AMD CPUs, and it works with the widest range of CPUs currently.
So if you're on Linux, you're lucky because
indeed
you can target more CPUs.
Mm-hmm. I see. And then on Windows, there are multiple options, right? So
right.
You said we're Axum first.
Right.
What are we second?
Windows Hypervisor Platform.
I see. And what are the advantages, or why would you use that?
Well, a lot of our users, they are in a development environment where they are on Windows, and they also use other services such as Docker. That
I see.
Require Microsoft virtualization technology, Hyper-V. And so one of the things that Windows Hypervisor Platform provides is a way to run the emulator side by side with Docker, which is very valuable for many users. And second, it is the only solution that we have right now that allows you to run AMD CPUs on Windows with the emulator.
I see. And hypervisors can't typically be stacked, like one wins, right? Is that the case?
In some cases, they can, but you're right. In this case, that Axum and Hyper-V, they both make incompatible decisions as to what runs at what level. So they currently cannot be mixed.
But wait, can I run a Axum inside a virtualized environment within Axum? And then you could have...
He said the word inception earlier, so I'm thinking yes.
Yes, so that's kind of what we saw some users do, which is run the Windows emulator in Axum inside Parallels Desktop, which is using Hypervisor Framework on Mac.
All right.
I think there...
Because you could.
Right, yeah, because you can. And there might be a way to get this to work on a Hyper-V Windows. Maybe inside there's another Windows that has Axum, and that might work out, but it will...
It's probably not the best way to conserve the resources on your on your machine. Mm-hmm. But glad it works. It's pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah. The other thing I remember well about snapshots was all the issues with GPU. So we talked about the register thing, but also just finding drivers, even without snapshots, was tricky, right? So last year we were showing off the new AR core. Is that what it's called?
AR core. AR core is just it does detection and tracking of objects for AR. It's not a renderer.
Okay, so, what is the...
So Synform is the thing that goes on top of...
Synform was what I was thinking of. Yeah. So that was using your rendering library called...
Filament.
Filament, which we've had an episode about. And it would not work on my Linux box. And so I panicked and I went to Frank and he pulled a rabbit out of his hat. No, it was a driver. What are all the issues with handling OpenGL and drivers in the emulator?
What are not the issues?
Yes.
Right.
And there's all these choices, right? In the settings for emulator, I can choose what level I want.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, so... it can be difficult to support OpenGL on a desktop app. It's probably like the high level bit. So you're gonna get all sorts of different drivers on Linux, macOS, and Windows, and all have different limitations. But after you run into a lot of problems for a long time, you start to see the trends, which is good that there is a trend. So on Windows, we generally use OpenGL. Except for some of the older Intel GPUs, which, such as HD 4000 and lower, which can have incompatibilities running the latest API levels with OpenGL ES3. In these cases, we will use OpenGL ES2 and force the user to use Direct3D. So there's this library called Angle. It's used in Chrome to work around similar issues. It translates OpenGL ES calls to Direct3D calls, and it works pretty great.
Yeah, and Angle also includes a lot of driver workarounds.
Indeed.
For those reasons. Yeah, so some of the things that are difficult in emulating OpenGL, so you have OpenGL ES2, you have OpenGL ES3.0, 3.1, and 3.2.
Right.
And on Linux and Windows, typically you have access to very recent versions of OpenGL desktop that are a superset of those OpenGL ES. On Mac, unfortunately, the version of OpenGL is 4.1, which is by now 7 or 8 years old. So ES 3.1 and 2 on mobile have features that don't exist in OpenGL on macOS, like compute shaders.
Right.
And so that's why we're in this situation where, depending on the GPU you have and the operating system you have, different versions of OpenGL ES in the emulator will be supported or not.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what contributes to us being like an OpenGL ES 3.0 first kind of emulator and not a 3.1.
And the emulator is the reason why Filament now supports ES 3.0. We started with 3.1, and it was because that was the only way to get it to run on Mac.
I remember when we had the original Instant Run launch, and we had this really beautiful demo written by Romain. It was like this chessboard, you know, with metallic surfaces, and it was rotating. And it was a it was a great demo of, hey, we can just tweak this parameter on the fly in the editor, hit run, half a second later, it's visually updated. You know, and we wanted to run this demo on the emulator because it's always easier to do that when you can have the IDE and the emulator side by side, single screenshot. But, you know, Romain couldn't help himself. He loaded it up with OpenGL features, and so it didn't run on the emulator.
It did use compute shaders.
Yes. So we had to instead use, you know, what is it, Wolf Vision? You know, when you put, we actually had to put a cradle and film the device so we could do the demo.
Okay. No, but yeah, it's interesting because, you know, emulators are extremely useful for in CI environments for testing. So it is important to be able to target those lower versions, but it can be difficult when you build OpenGL apps to have to be limited to older versions of GL. And we have another solution at Google that I think the emulator can use, so Swift Shader, which is a software implementation. And funnily enough, like, so itself doesn't support yet all the features of OpenGL ES, and on top of it, it's kind of its own driver. So we've had bugs that we found, for instance, in Filament, that were bugs on our side because Swift Shader was implementing the spec slightly differently, but Swift Shader was right. Or we also found bugs in Swift Shader. So it's just the emulator basically adds new drivers and more fun to the mix of but yeah, it's still pretty impressive that, you know, it's very transparent. Like, again, like, you know, we have fairly complex rendering engine with modern features, and thanks to the emulator team, like, it works. And they did a lot of work. Like, we even received the patches for our own engine to make it work better, which we appreciate.
And I think we maybe had an ADB episode about this last year, where we talked to Jamal about the emulator. So I think we've talked about the fact that we now ship a Play Store image, right? A system image with the Play Store in it. But what's amazing there is that means you can install the Play Store, you can download games, and they run.
Actually, and I have a question for you since you're here. Do all the system images that we provide, at least the x86 ones, do they all have hardware support for ES3? Because sometimes I remember, like, sometimes I was confused, like my x86 64 image didn't have it, but the x86 had it.
So we're still kind of working on this, but like we first introduced our OpenGL ES 3.0 support as part of our one of our first CTS efforts. So and that was around Android N API 24, and that was when it was first introduced. I'm not sure if it made it back to older API levels, but since they use a shared repository for the driver code, that should be the case. Although. And then after every API level after that forward, we included OpenGL ES 3 and the latest drivers with them.
Okay, so no matter which system image you're using, that should work.
Right.
And does that work even if I use ARM?
Yes, it should work even if you use ARM. Because it's done, or at least it's supposed to be done in an architecture-independent way where we don't assume size of size T is 4 or 8 or something.
So speaking of choosing system images, I know I asked this of the emulator team in the past, and I probably forgot to follow up. But, you know, in the AVD manager, we try to recommend what is the right system image to use. So we hide, you know, there's like, this is the one you should choose, but if not, there's some fallback ones.
Right.
And I was never sure. Clearly, I should use x86, not ARM. But I was never sure what is the best choice of 32-bit or 64-bit.
So 32-bit is still the best choice and probably will be for some time going forward, even though in recent system images, starting with API 27, we are using a 32-bit user space on a 64-bit kernel. The reason for this is that there are often a lot more 32-bit x86 apps on the Play Store.
Let's say I'm just a developer and I have a 64-bit machine.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason why I would choose 32-bit versus 64-bit, or which one is better for me developing my app? Or does it not matter? Like, one uses more RAM, I take it.
Well, yes, the 64-bit version will use more RAM. But another reason to use 32-bit is, besides RAM, is because of the compatibility. If you're targeting real devices at some point, then that's something that you'll really need to consider. At least, or if you want, maybe you should favor the 64-bit if you're looking very forward, if you want to be kind of like the future.
But it sounds 30. Like if you're running a pure Java or pure mm-hmm. Kotlin application and you don't yes. have native code and mm-hmm. and your libraries don't have native code, then it doesn't right. matter.
Yes, then it doesn't really matter, and it kind of falls down to which one is easier to use and consumes less resources. And right. so x86 32 still ends up being a bit better.
Okay. All right. Practical advice on the podcast.
I like it.
Is there anything we haven't talked about? Talk about snapshots, GPUs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot to the emulator, right? Like in the UI, I really like next to the emulator, there's that small bar and there's access to a lot of stuff. You can right. feed data to all the sensors. There's mm-hmm. that beautiful orientation sensor where you have a 3D view of Nexus 5 or something.
Yes.
Did you write that?
Oh, no, I didn't. Grigori Javadan did.
Okay.
But we were still on the team. It was pretty cool. We also joked about having that model of the phone display what was on the screen at the current moment.
So it's funny because around the same time, I actually did a demo of Filament to folks on the Tools team, and I did exactly that. I was showing that with a physically based renderer, we could simulate, the glossy screen outside, so that based on the brightness of the screen, you could test your app in different visibility environments and see how readable your application is.
Mm-hmm. Wow,
we should do that.
Indeed.
With smudges on the screen and cracked top corner.
Right,
or
even just the fact that, depending on the colors you choose or the things, like it may be hard to read outside.
Speaking of colors, I'm very happy the emulator has a dark theme. It would be cool. We should make sure, if we haven't already, that we are matching the Darkula colors other than just generally being dark colors.
Just for consistency. I also really like the dark theme as well.
You're all about the dark theme, Tor.
Yeah, totally.
So dark.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you. And thanks for all the work. Like, the emulator is really amazing now.
Thanks.
It has come a long way.
Yeah, we used to get all this feedback that wasn't entirely positive. That has completely changed.
Thank you.
Thank you.